First place of Lahore Bazaar in Pakistan. It is. Yes, it is.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
Very colorful. It's yeah. it has so much historic meaning and symbolism. And as I said, you know, I think it's sort of the melting pot. You know, in Pakistan, the bazaar represents sort of the lifeblood of the community. And for a lot of small business owners that have little stalls, that's the only way they can get by is by selling things. And so it just, for me, was a remarkable place. Again, I'm from small town America, and I grew up in a small community, and knowing that I was different, people would oftentimes ask me, where's Haroon from? Where are you from? And I would say, well, I'm from East Richland. They say, no, but where are you really from? And so, you know, I knew that I was different growing up, but I think that also was an incredible asset because it made me keenly aware and observing people around me. And then when I went to Pakistan, it helped me build trust with families.
So the character that you mentioned, the father, who is sort of the story in a way revolves around the father, Awais, and he was born in 1947 at the same time that Pakistan was created. Am I getting that right?
That's right. That's right. He was, you know, in a lot of ways, he grew up in that generation, the birth generation that lived through partition, that saw the oftentimes, you know, people forget that partition between India and Pakistan when British India was split was the largest mass transfer of people in the history of the world. Over 7 million people changed and got up and either moved to one side or the other. And so there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of things that happened at that time, a lot of sectarian violence. And so the generation was really shaped by those moments in history.
And you have an incredible beginning to this book where he is returning to his neighborhood. Do you want to tell a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It was this really sort of iconic moment where, as I mentioned, Awais was, you know, he had walked over 1,000 miles to get back home. He was a POW, left in East Pakistan in Dhaka during the 1971 war. And there weren't many POWs, and there weren't many people that were able to get back to Pakistan. And so I was always sort of, you know, fascinated by what is it that drives somebody to walk, to hitchhike, to jump on small little cars and trucks to get back home and, you know, really understand. And to me, that's the core of this book, is to understand how people develop these coping mechanisms. How do they deal with stress? How does this family that could have been torn apart 2 or 3 times come together? And, you know, to me, it's a story of triumph and resilience and justice. And I think it's a story that needs to be told because most Americans and the, you know, my community that I grew up in on my street, people like Dr. Christensen, they see a very different Pakistan on TV. And so I wanted to make this Pakistan accessible to them, bring this dinner table conversation into their homes to humanize it. And so we can go beyond some of the headlines because there's this other side of Pakistan that people don't get to see.
I would love to add something here as well. You wrote a book about announcing Pakistan. This is the main thing. This is the main agenda why we people are here, like the journalists from through ICFJ Pakistan. I'm, in fact, very thankful to ICFJ they have taken this step. Because the news, which I am emphasizing here, the news which we used to hear is a small part of Pakistan. It's a different part of Pakistan. There is another side of the Pakistani picture as well. There is a beautiful Pakistan. There is a very moderate Pakistan as well, which everyone should know about.
Absolutely. And I think as bad as things oftentimes are, they may seem, and there are some really legitimate issues and there are a lot of internal issues that Pakistan is dealing with. You know, a country of, you know, almost 190 million people. I sometimes forget, fourth most populous, going to be in the next 15 years, an incredible amount of people, you know, in a very small geography, about the size of Wisconsin and Michigan and Indiana, you know, 200 million people. And so oftentimes, we see these headlines, but we forget that this is not how things always were. In fact, you only have to go back a little bit in history. You see Jackie Kennedy, you know, in a motorcade in Lahore. You see President Eisenhower attending a cricket match in Pakistan. You see President Nixon on the back of a truck in Pakistan. You see President Lyndon Johnson meeting a rickshaw driver that he met in Pakistan back to the White House. And so I think it is too important for us to ignore, and is too important, not for us, but also our the future generations, that we bridge this divide. And I'm cautiously optimistic about Pakistan.
Well, it same goes in America as well. If you heard about a news from America or from a specific part of America, it doesn't mean it can represent the whole America. It can represent the whole U.S. Mm-hmm. There are other parts of U.S. as well. It's a big country. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Same goes with Pakistan. If we heard about something, it's a specific part of Pakistan. Obviously, there is another Pakistan as well. It's so beautiful. We have Lahore, we have Karachi, we have Gujranwala, we have Multan, we have Sargodha. So many cities are there.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point, Sadia. Wow. And you know, that part of what this story jumped out at me and why I felt so compelled to write about this family is because I felt there was actually so many similarities between small town America and Pakistan, more than, you know, I would have ever imagined. You know, this family, the Reza family, the parents, they're just like blue collar families like myself and those that grew up down the street in Eastern Washington. They wanted to provide more for their kids than they had themselves. They wanted to give them a better education than they had. You know, it was all hands on deck. Just like I grew up a paper boy and my sister mowed lawns. I mean, Awais Riza is working, his wife is working, all the kids are trying to work in their own capacity in the formal, informal economy. And so there's a lot of similarities that we, you know, that middle class, lower middle class families have to small town America and Pakistan. And I wanted to bring that to life because I think that's an important dimension for people to experience.
You mentioned a family. There are three sons, and how does the family, the sons in the family, how would do they represent some different aspects of choice for young Pakistani men?
That's a great question, Kathleen. I think in a few ways that they represent. I mean, each of the sons takes, obviously, a divergent path. You know, the oldest, Suleiman, goes to military school and drops out of boarding school. Awais is trying to remake him in his image as somebody that joins the military, that's able to sort of, you know, keep up the family legacy. You know, the middle son Danyal is swept into, you know, getting recruited. He falls into the wrong group of friends and is recruited by some of the extremist groups, as many youngsters are in Pakistan. They face these alternative narratives, and oftentimes there is a toxic environment, you know, in Pakistan. And lastly, Kamran, I think, was, you know, as he's becoming a lawyer, you know, he sort of is interested in the constitutional dimensions, the law, governance. He was part of the lawyers movement. That was this big event and sort of mobilization about 6 years ago in Pakistan. And so in their own way, they represent the landscape of in Pakistan. You know, you have strong women as well. You have Shez working as a nurse in one of the hospitals. And which is oftentimes, you know, you find she's going against a lot of norms, working day in and day out, literally doing triage. And you have Rania, who Kamran gets married to. And, you know, she's also this very strong lawyer, independent. And so you find it sort of interesting. And I met countless families that represented these types, this Pakistan. And I thought it's important because, again, within one family, they're dealing with these tensions. It's within one family they could be torn apart. It's not something that's so different. Each family is struggling within to get by day to day.
The character that we mentioned, the character that this, I keep saying character, but it is a real person. He is a real person,
that's
always.
Right.
Has this incredible thing happen in his life where he is jailed. And do you want to talk a little bit more about that, about his dilemma, about being jailed for reasons related to his son who becomes involved with the terrorist group?
Yes. I mean, this is what I saw in Pakistan that a lot of people don't realize, that Pakistan has taken the brunt of the war on terror. You know, Pakistan's lost over 50,000 civilians, you know, in this war. And you've lost over 4,000 military service members. And so
we are still on this war. We are still on the war against terrorists. We are just keep on helping out all over the world. Anyone who needs help, we are there.
And I think that, you know, the Awais is caught between, he knows that his son has fallen in with the wrong group of friends. And he knows that, and as late at night, he used to tell me, Haroon, you know, could I have done something differently? Did I fail as a parent? You know, we would oftentimes, I smile thinking about it, we would eat a lot of mangoes. It was over a bag of mangoes that we would have these conversations. And I oftentimes in my mind, I think, you know, with all due respect to Greg Mortensen and Three Cups of Tea, it's actually about mangoes. Mangoes are the best icebreaker. It's not tea. It's mangoes. I don't know, Kathleen, have you eaten a mango with your hands? I don't know.
Not too much.
Okay, well, it's if you eat a mango with your hands, it's not a very clean process. I mean, you're ripping out that mango, you're digging
it's
out the pit.
It's very difficult to have a mango, yeah.
All of the juices are flowing down your face. And I bet you if you eat three mangoes with somebody, you get to know them really fast, really quickly. All your guard is down. And so it's one of the best trust-building things you can do. And so over a course of oftentimes eating mangoes, a waste would tell me, you know, I'm struggling with this. What do I do? I love my son on one hand. He's still my son. He's still part of my blood. Yet I know he's doing something very wrong. And he's gotten in this wrong group of friends and I don't know what to do. And so he's caught in jail, being pressured into sort of taking a side. And that's part of the tension. You know, I met countless families that knew somebody that lost somebody in violence, whether a suicide bombing or attack. They may have known somebody, a family member who may have been recruited, or a cousin that had been sort of gone down the wrong path. And so these are things that families have to deal with. It's part of coping. It's not something that's separate, that only a select few have to deal with. Oftentimes, most families have seen, they live with this fear, they see the violence around them, and yet they have to continue chugging along day to day.
There's a question, the son who is a law student, one of his professors throws out a question, I believe, and asks, are people benefiting from the alliance with the West, and to his class? And then he asks, who is? And the class says, well, I think the class says the military is. So is that a question that Pakistani people are constantly dealing with, are constantly debating and talking about?
Absolutely. I think it's one of the central questions I find that young people are debating about. You know, they're looking at, you know, who are the political stakeholders? Who should be in power? I mean, we had this really remarkable election last year. I was an election observer in Pakistan. And to see young people coming out to vote, and older people, women that had never voted before. So, you know, it was the first ever democratically elected government that had been handed over power from another democratically elected government in Pakistan's history. And so you find young people talking about this. They're a new generation and they're mobilized. You know, they now have social media is growing, but there's an incredible information environment in Pakistan, over 80 plus TV channels. You know, 110 million people have access to TV. Remarkable in terms of sources of information. And so young people are discussing this. They want to know answers and they're going to go out in the streets to make sure that they're heard.
And how about physically living in Pakistan? We hear about power outages and food lines. Are those common problems?
Yes, I mean it's prevalent. You know, there's this term called load shedding, which is where in most parts of Pakistan, especially in Lahore, you may go 8 hours or 10 hours without electricity because the electric grid is over capacity, and yet, you know, people are content. They are able to find a source of contentment and happiness. You know, I lived in Pakistan for many years. I lived in a very small village. I've lived in, you know, different parts of Pakistan. And I just find the sort of resilience of everyday Pakistanis to be remarkable. You know, they're able to find a way to continue going to day to day and find silver linings in their daily work. And so it's tough. You know, the electricity outages, you have 2/3 of the country lives under $2 a day. So you have a lot of poverty, you know, a lot of poor people, a lot of urban poor. You see the slums are right next to the sort of, you know, the big houses. You know, there's a lot of segregation in cities.
They hike off petroleum prices as well. Mm-hmm. But still they are struggling to find the way how to go on with the life. They are very strong. And what I saw from during the last 5 to 10 years, women became quite much strong. If we talk about different cities of Pakistan, they are like, if they are a housewife or if they are a working woman, they are struggling a lot to help their families, and they are struggling equally with all the problems their families are facing. They have become very powerful.
We're listening to Sadia Khan, who is a journalist from Pakistan, and she is here with me. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and we're speaking with writer Haroon Ullah about his new book, The Bargain from the Bazaar, A Family's Day of Reckoning in Lahore. In writing this book, Haroon, did you feel like you got to the main themes that you wanted to get to about Pakistan? Are there other parts of the world there that you would like to explore more in the future, or how do you feel about that?
I think, you know, what I wanted to do was to humanize his family. I wanted to humanize Pakistan to the small town America where I grew up in. And I wanted to sort of make it accessible so people could see the story, and then as they read the story of this true family, they can make their own conclusions about what strikes them about that. And, you know, I this is a labor of love. I mean, I don't think of myself as a professional writer. You know, I'm an academic, I'm a policy person. My first book was called Vying for Allah's Vote, and really looked at more of the policy dimensions of, you know, what we see in Pakistan, the political dynamics. And that book was a sort of my take on what lessons does Pakistan have for the rest of the world? In fact, how does Pakistan inform the Arab Spring? Because Pakistan is this remarkable crucible. If you want to look at religious parties, you've had religious parties in Pakistan since 1906 in Pakistan, over 100 years of existence. And so, you know, I wanted to sort of, people oftentimes want to pigeonhole South Asia, but South Asia has a lot of lessons for the rest of the world. So, you know, I just feel so honored that people would read the book. And, you know, I've been just flattered that, you know, it's gotten some reviews now in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Review of Books, Mother Jones. And to me, it's just, I feel blessed to have been able to tell that story, because I always found myself in sort of the middle of those worlds colliding. As somebody that grew up in small town America, I was able to go to Pakistan and live there. I was able to navigate because I knew the language. I knew the customs. I knew when to speak up. And I certainly knew when to shut up. And, you know, I think about this one story. When I was in Anarkali one day, I was in the back of the bazaar, and it was load shedding. Electricity was out. And I remember I heard out of the sort of corner of my ear a song. And I was thinking to myself, I can't be hearing this song. I'm in the middle of the oldest bazaar in Pakistan and in South Asia. And it was a Garth Brooks song. And I grew up listening to country music. And so it was remarkable to sort of, you know, I had this aha moment. I went over to the stall where the gentleman was playing this song, and I asked him, did you know what this song is? He shook his head, and he was just playing it on his battery operated CD player. But to me, you know, this is small town America, you know, colliding with in Pakistan. And, you know, I grew up listening to country music because my youngest brother was born with a congenital heart defect and Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so that was the music that soothed him in the hospital when he went through two open heart surgeries. Mm-hmm. So our family embraced it. And so it was just, to me, showing how interdependent our worlds are. So, you know, Pakistan's not some far off place. What happens in Pakistan affects us in small town America. And what happens in small town America affects us in Pakistan.
I was interested in your research, particularly regarding the story of, do you say it, Donnie?
Mm-hmm.
His story, he's the one that became involved with the group that ended up doing some bombings.
That's correct.
Very famous bombings, I assume those are famous.
That's right.
Bombings.
That's right. You know, and a lot of my research in Pakistan, in my first book, Vying for Allah's Vote, I spent a lot of time going to camps and interviewing young people about why they got recruited in some of these extremist groups, whether it was Sipah Sabah, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Lashkar-e-Jangvi, the Taliban, Tehrik-e-Taliban. There's sort of these groups, these extremist groups in Pakistan, and understanding what is it that made them join? What is it that, you know, led them down that path? What was it that sort of drove them in that direction? And so I oftentimes met these young people. I met them in the camps. I interviewed a lot of times their commanders. I lived in the northern areas of Pakistan for a little less than a year in the federal tribal agencies. And so I wanted to understand, and it so happened that this family was struggling with that very same thing, that one of their children that they had given the best of their education to, that he had had the best schooling, had caught up with the wrong group of friends. And had sort of bought into this sort of ideology and identity, and was being led down this path right in front of their eyes. And that, to me, was to see this family, how do they deal with you know, the other brothers with one of their brother, they know he was with the wrong group of friends and they really starkly disagree. And yet they also, that's their brother. And so they were trying to sort of, how do they intervene to stop him going down this path? And to me, that was sort of the core of the story, is that there are young people that get caught up in getting recruited. And yet I also meet a lot of young people that are fighting against that, that are speaking out against that through arts and music and drama. And so that to me is the two competing visions you find in Pakistan. And where I felt that that's, you know, the future of Pakistan rests between those two poles.
Well, Harun, are you planning to return to Pakistan soon?
I'd love to. I just got back from 3.5 years in Pakistan last summer. And, you know, I love traveling. I think traveling is the best classroom that you can imagine. So I love going to, I've lived in India. I lived in Pakistan. I lived in Bangladesh and spent time in Afghanistan as well as the Middle East. And so I would love to go back. I'd love to go back because I have a lot of close friends and family friends there. And so it's, I just think that Pakistan is too important to ignore. It is something that is, it is a place where investment being made in the people-to-people exchange will pay off, both for the U.S. and Pakistan.
Yes, inshallah, it will.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in while you were in Portland and talking about your book, and thank you so much, Harun.
Kathleen, thanks absolutely for having me. I'm as a Pacific Northwest native and as a listener of this community radio station, it's an absolute honor for me to be here to talk about my book and to engage with listeners. And I look forward to feedback on Bargain from the Bazaar. Thank you so much.
And thank you also, Sadia, for sitting in.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for inviting me here. I can understand it was an interview specifically for Mr. Harun, but you invited me as well, and I enjoyed it. It was so informative, and it is always a fun while discussing a moderate and beautiful Pakistani things. So I liked it. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Sadia. And I will tell people again that Harun Ullah is the author of The Bargain from the Bazaar, and the subtitle to that book is A Family's Day of Reckoning in Lahore. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU Public Affairs. Thank you for listening.
It's 9:29. You're tuned to KABU. Coming right up, we hear an excerpt from Economic Update with host Richard Wolf. Stay tuned. And 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia.
Let me turn then to introduce my guest today, Vanessa Brandsburg. Thank you, Vanessa, very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Let me tell you a little bit about Vanessa before we start talking. Vanessa Brandsburg is the Director of Cooperative Development at the Center for Family Life in Brooklyn, New York. Since February 2008, she has been providing co-op incubation consultation. Well, that's a nice way of saying she's helping co-ops get developed, begin, and grow. And she's been doing it in Sunset Park, which is a part of Brooklyn. There, she has particularly worked, and that's what we're going to be discussing with her, worker-owned cooperative businesses run by immigrants that have arrived in Brooklyn, New York. In the last couple of years, Vanessa has been at the forefront of creating and running the New York City Cooperative Development Initiative, which provides year-long support to community-based organizations in New York as they learn to become practitioners in cooperative worker enterprise development. Vanessa is also one of the founders of the New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives, which we all know here as NICNOC, and she serves on the board as well of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. Tell us a little bit about the Center of Family Life in Brooklyn, what it is, what it does.
So the Center for Family Life was established in 1978. It's a program of SCO Family of Services, which is a larger agency that has programs all over New York City. And the Center for Family Life really started actually by two nuns of the Good Shepherd, just doing family counseling and foster care work in Sunset Park neighborhood, very locally. And then over the years, it's really expanded to have about 9 different programs, at like after school, community services program with a food pantry, different arts programs, and so forth. And where I am based is the Adult Employment Program, and that's where the Worker Co-op Project really came out of. So basically, the Center for Family Life has really taken the decision to go in the direction of developing worker-owned co-ops back in 2006, when we really saw a need to work with people in the neighborhood that were experiencing multiple barriers to employment, where the traditional employment program wasn't able to meet. So we really started looking and investigating into models that had, you know, obviously been used all over the world for many, many years, but more recently with immigrants in the United States, reaching out to folks in California, here locally in Long Island and in Staten Island.
You know, I'm struck by it because I have talked on this program fairly often about the Mondragon Corporation, mm-hmm. this extraordinarily successful set, really a family of worker co-ops in Spain. Mm-hmm. And they started also as an action of the Catholic Church, of mm-hmm. a priest, Arizmendi, in the north of Spain, the Basque territory, 1956, a handful of 6 workers. And here we are, half a century later, 100,000 people involved in this operation. It is proof that worker co-ops not only can survive, but can grow, can go from small enterprises to large enterprises. And you know, the interesting thing that the historians say is that they made the decision, this Catholic priest, mm-hmm. to go in the direction of co-op precisely for the reason you just said, that waiting for capitalist enterprises, people interested in making a profit in the conventional way, was simply taking too long mm-hmm. and leading to too much suffering of too many people over too long a period of time, and that mm-hmm. this alternative model, the co-op, right. would be a way to do what a conventional enterprise strategy wouldn't achieve. Is that similar, in a sense, yes. to to what you arrived at the Center for Family Life?
Yeah, it's very similar, because the reality was that the folks that we were working with, mostly immigrants, recent immigrants, were just left out of the system. And so there were really no alternatives to finding good living wage jobs except for the exploitative positions that they had been holding, doing domestic work, working at factories in the waterfront, working at restaurants. And so they wanted something different. And there were really no other options. So we had to recreate that with our own standard, in our own way.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty. Tell us about the cooperative that has been the major project and the major achievement of your work over the last few years. Mm-hmm. And give us, you know, your own sense and your own feelings about that kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's 2 cooperatives that have been extremely successful that I have been partnering with in the last few years. The first one, which was the first co-op that we worked with, is called Si Se Puede Women's Cleaning Cooperative, or in English, We Can Do It. The women came together in 2006. It was about 15 people at the time, 15 founding members, and really—
All women?
All women, mm-hmm. exactly. They had been using ESL classes, family counseling in the program, so we already had a relationship with them, so that trust was already developed. And we approached them and said, hey, you know, we know that it's been something that you've been desiring to have pursue entrepreneurship. Have you heard of the co-op model? A lot of them actually identified with that because of where they came from, either from Mexico or Puerto Rico. It's very natural. And then we started looking at different industries, and it made most sense to go into the cleaning services because it's something that they had already known to do. So the skills were already there, so that wouldn't have been an uphill battle at all. And we started working with them to develop the business skills. So we started doing business planning. We started doing the brand development. We talked about marketing strategies. And in between those sessions, we also started doing peer training around cleaning services. So they started teaching one another. And then we really started connecting with our different networks around around to build a client base. And the women were very eager to do this. It wasn't easy because they had to basically put forward a lot of time. It wasn't so much monetary investment, but it was more sweat equity in terms of coming to meetings to plan, you know, forming committees, doing marketing and hitting the streets to do that. And we went alongside with them to do that. And over the years, what we've seen is they've grown tremendously in terms of the demand. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that their clients really understand where they're coming from and really want to do the right thing and support a social, a worker-owned business that's being led by its owners. So they know that the people doing the cleaning have a really big stake in it. So what we've seen over the years is tremendous is before joining the cooperative, a lot of the women were earning maybe $7 to $10 an hour doing cleaning, sometimes being asked to do childcare at the same time, which is difficult to do both. And now in Cisapuede, they're earning between $20 to $25 an hour, depending on how much they work. Some people choose to do full-time, some part-time. So it's been a tremendous leap income-wise, which, of course, affects their family, situation.
I'd like to pick up on many dimensions of what you said, but here's a couple. I'm struck by what you say about the ability of these women in that co-op to find clients, folks who will buy the services they're producing, who want not just to get their place clean, their store, their factory, their office, whatever it is, but who also want to buy something from an entity whose way of organizing work they want to help. In other words, it gives them a competitive advantage in the marketplace that they, in a sense, offer a customer two things, the cleaning service, but also the chance to help build a co-op sector in the community. And for many clients, this matters. This isn't they would make a choice for a co-op rather than a conventional business.
That's right.
Because many folks wonder whether a co-op can succeed in the capitalist marketplace. You're basically saying,
it's
here's
super
one that
competitive.
Did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. And I think it has to do with the fact that, there, people are really seeking out, how to have a relationship with the person that's engaging with them and their family and their home, and not to hire somebody from an agency where there's a middleman and everything's very vague and they don't really know what's happening. And to know that it's women not just cleaning, but they're also producing a product right now, a cleaning product. They're becoming leaders. They're in the forefront of the network.